Welcome back, everyone. This is The Damage Report. I'm John Arola. Big old packed show for you today. Not only are we going to be dealing with the fallout, so to speak, of the climate town hall yesterday, the 7-hour extravaganza that CNN held with a number of different candidates for the Democratic primary. We've got a lot more. The show really, like thematically, a good portion of it is going to be dealing with the problem of Joe Biden, both Joe Biden's current problems and his past problems. So current problems on the climate, past problems on the war in Iraq. And recently he's been attempting to rewrite his history on support for the war in Iraq. Well, we've got the verbal receipts that he collected over the course of many years. We're going to be comparing what he was saying at the time to what he is presenting as what he was saying now. And we're going to contrast him with Bernie Sanders. Some video in the run up to the war in Iraq from Bernie Sanders on the in government. Pretty amazing quotes there. We're going to be dealing with Ed Buck. We've got, let's see, the opioid crisis. What is the media getting wrong about that? And then near the end of the show, a lot of you have been asking for a long time, can we do some sort of like crowdfunding campaign to pay to get Steve King to drink out of a toilet? Well, he did it for free, and we're going to be showing you the video later on today. It's only semi-joking. He sort of drank out of a toilet, so we'll have that for you. But we're going to be starting off with the climate town hall. Last night, CNN held their 7-hour climate town hall. A number of different candidates, 40 minutes each. A lot to cover. We're going to start though with Joe Biden. So I want to show you a section of a mashup that was put together by Walker Bragman. Now understand, this is a mashup and mashups do exaggerate certain things. But I want you to watch this and get an idea of some of what was going on during Joe Biden's portion of the town hall.
I've been involved in everything from making sure we go with the back in the 90s. Everything I've done has been done to take on the polluters. And I was the one that suggested to the president, President Obama, I don't want to confuse presidents here.
He currently supports Senator Bernie Sanders, but you could change his mind tonight. Who knows, Isaac?
It doesn't look like I'd do that with it.
Tomorrow, you are holding a high dollar fundraiser hosted by Andrew Goldman, a fossil fuel executive.
He is not a fossil fuel executive. I've also been one of those people who, when I was chairman of the Foreign Relations Committee, got involved in plans to be able to join people together in order to take on these corporate interests. I would see to it for immediately moving toward, we're in fact in a position now that if in fact we dealt with mitigation across the board, just what we did in the last administration and before, leading to a standard that we provide efficiency for appliances. That saves billions of gallons of gasoline. I mean, billions of 2.3 billion dollars worth of, $500 billion in savings and 2.something billion metric tons of CO2 going in the air.
Okay, so there's some issues there. So as I said, full transparency, it is a mashup. And so mashups do focus on certain things. But look, let's just keep it real. You couldn't put together a mashup of any of the other candidates like that, having as much trouble putting together their thoughts, expressing what was going on, remembering accurately what they did in office. There was a bit of the sort of standard folksy Joe Biden stuff, but there wasn't even that much of that because he was having so much trouble just communicating, both with some of the people asking questions that are predisposed to not support him. They had one person you saw there, a question from him. And we're gonna return to that topic from a Bernie Sanders supporter. But even just regular sort of softball questions about what would you do? How would you prioritize? How would you put pressure on China? These sorts of things. Some of them, like climate change, is very much not Joe Biden's like favored topic. But if you are gonna be talking about it, he wants to talk about international diplomacy, his time traveling around as vice president. Like that is his area inside of this area. And even in that, he was just all over the place. We showed you 1 minute, 20 seconds of that. There's many minutes of these sorts of mashups. I'm not going to make you go through all of it, but this is a serious problem. It's a serious problem for debates and town halls because he's had those same sorts of problems at the two debates that we've had already. It's a problem for his public appearances where he sort of vacillates between not wanting to talk about his policies and not being able to talk about his policies. And if he has a debate with Donald Trump someday, like, don't you want someone to contrast against Donald Trump? Someone who is put together, serious, intellectual, has a memory, has an attachment to reality, isn't badass crazy. Wouldn't you like that? And there are multiple options where you could have that. But with Joe Biden, it's just getting worse. Mentally, he's basically like, he's at the same level as his eyes. I'm not gonna go into depth about the bloody eye, but I'm sure you've seen the pictures of the bloody eye. Like a blood vessel burst in his eye during the town hall. I don't think it means anything. I'm sure people will cook up all sorts of conspiracies about what it represents. But it was sort of a metaphor for what was going on. That's as far as I'm going to take it. But it's an issue. And when he wasn't sort of like flailing to try to figure out what he wants to say, what's the talking point I can cling to? It's like grabbing onto a buoy in like stormy water. He was going to generalities. And that's just a thing that's what his campaign is about. And let's just show you an example. Just one little example I noticed.
Bothers me most about what's going on in the country today. We're walking around with our heads down like, oh, what are we gonna do? We're in such great trouble. This is the United States of America. There's not a damn thing we've not been able to accomplish once we set our mind to it.
You noticed there the bloody eye was in that. Anyway, that by itself is perfectly okay. But coming from Joe Biden, there's a couple of problems with it. One, he very often goes to that sort of like, come on, America, what's going on thing? And we all get that. That's like the subtext of this whole show, but that's not the end point. That's the starting point. The starting point is, dear God, what have we wrought? But then you have to actually have the solutions. And look, technically, he has a climate proposal out there. We'll get to that in just a second, I guess. But it comes down to accountability, trustworthiness. And like, if you're going to put across the message like, we got our heads down, we can't achieve anything. What are you talking about, America? We can do anything. That message would resonate for multiple candidates in the primary, but perhaps least of all, outside of maybe Delaney, Joe Biden. Because he says there, we can accomplish anything we put our minds to. And then when you start to name specifics on climate change and on other issues, suddenly not so much. So look, banning fracking and shutting down the entire fracking industry, that's a big, bold thing. Difficult politically. Can we do it? Well, going by that one quote, sure, America, we can do anything we put our minds to. But no, not that. Not for Joe Biden. Can't do that. That crops up so often. The idea that in rhetoric, when we come together, we can accomplish anything. But let's just keep the anything kind of down low. Let's not aim too high with the anything. And I care so much less about the one-liners, the rhetoric, then what his actual platform is. What is he gonna shoot for were he to become president? And that is far less lofty than some of his rhetoric. So let's turn to the topic that was raised by the Bernie Sanders supporter who asked him a question about the fact that, yes, he's here at the climate town hall, that's good. Yes, he has a climate plan, but it would have been tomorrow, it will be today, he's going to a fundraiser. This is a fundraiser hosted by Andrew Goldman, co-founder of Western LNG, a natural gas production company based in Houston, Texas. It's co-hosting one of two high-dollar fundraisers Biden will attend in New York today, actually. Goldman served as an advisor to Biden, by the way, while he was in the Senate, and was the Northeast Director of Finance for Biden's 2008 campaign. And if you didn't watch the town hall, you need to know that there was a learning process going on in real time around this fundraiser. So when the question was initially raised, why are you at a town hall today where you say we're gonna have to get off of all this dirty energy, we're gonna have to deal with the climate crisis seriously, and then tomorrow you're getting money raised for you by a guy who started up this natural gas production company. I know there's some back and forth about whether he's technically a fossil fuel executive. That's a distinction without a difference. He starts companies that take dirty energy out of the ground and then burn it and ruin our climate. Okay, that's the important part. And Biden had an issue with that characterization initially and said, well, is that real? Is he really? And then they came back from a commercial break and Anderson Cooper was cluing him in on who this guy was. The thing is, he was your advisor. How do you not know what industry he's in? He was working with you in the Senate, director of finance for Biden's campaign. Like, this is a guy that he knows in a fundraising context. But when it's raised in a town hall, suddenly, what name so? Andrew Goldman? Gold who? I don't know who that is. But you're willing to take his money, right? You're willing to go. You're busy. You're doing this whole presidential campaigning thing. And you're going to this guy's place. You have no idea who he is, what he represents, what he's working towards. Do you think he wants to ban fracking? Do you think that that's the game that he wants to get involved in? Kind of doubt it. Now look, if you look at his actual plan, it's not terrible. Biden pitched it as all the environmental groups say it's a B+ at worst. Okay, that's good. The crisis is not a B+, though. It's an A+. And I think that we need an A+ solution. Anyway, look, Biden does set a goal of getting the US to 100% renewable energy by 2050, technically, yes. Remember, though, just a few months ago, he was proposing a middle ground on climate policy. Now, they have retreated from that middle ground, and rightfully so. It was not received well. And sure, he's at the climate town hall now. But I remember where just a few months ago he was, and it was very much in the middle ground. And again, that's not where the climate crisis is. It's not compromising with us. It's sticking to its guns, so to speak. And you might have seen in that graphic there, his climate policy advisor, Heather Zeichal, has made more than $1 million from a natural gas firm after leaving the Obama administration. So look, if you had this guy who's starting natural gas companies as your advisor raising money for you back when you were in the Senate, then after you're running for president now, it's not 5 years ago, 10 years ago, 50 years ago, your climate advisor is making bank off of fossil fuels, then how much do I really trust your plan? If your plan is being crafted by a person who has a direct financial interest in maintaining the current status quo when it comes to energy production, energy generation, then I just can't trust you in the same way that I can trust some other people. Bernie Sanders does not have advisors who are like, you know what, we gotta get off coal, and by the way, give me that coal money. Like, that's not how other people are running things, or at least not other front runners are running things. Look, there was a lot more that I wish I could talk about. I'm focusing on Biden because for some reason, Biden is still in first place, despite the fact that his campaign is basically one blood-soaked eye after another. He's still in first place, so we have to take him seriously. There was more going on. Perhaps we'll circle back to it tomorrow. Anyway, we do have to take a short break. We come back, lots more to get to.
We need to talk about a relatively new show called the Republic, or UNFTR. As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies, debunking the conventional wisdom. In each episode of the Republic, or UNFTR, the host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated by the so-called powers that be, featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity. The UNFTR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFTR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it,
"You must unlearn what you have learned."
And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today and get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time.
Ed Buck is a Democratic activist and campaign donor. You might have heard his name before, but probably not for those two qualifiers. It's for something far darker, something far more dangerous. His house has, over the past few years, been an incredibly dangerous sort of place. And there's been an investigation going on to find out why two individuals have died while with Ed Buck. We want to learn more about this incredibly strange story. So we're joined now by journalist and advocate Jasmine Kanick. Jasmine, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Thank you so much for joining us and for doing an incredible amount of work over a couple of years to find out what's going on here. So what do people need to know about Ed Buck?
Well, what people need to know is that Ed Buck is a major donor to the Democratic Party, particularly here in California. He is a well-known HIV/AIDS advocate, activist, as well as an animal activist. And he's also a man who, within the past 2 years, 16 months apart, had two black gay men die in his house of crystal meth overdoses. The first young man died in July 2017. His name was Jamel Moore. When he died, the sheriff's department just took Ed Buck's word for what happened, and that was it. They closed the case. It wasn't until I published Jamel Moore's journal where he talked about Ed Buck being the first one to give him meth and to get him hooked on meth and all the things that Ed Buck was doing, that the sheriff's department was forced to open a homicide investigation 19 days later. So all the evidence, everything was gone. So at the end of the year meaning from July 2017 to July 2018, the DA's office decided that they just didn't have enough evidence to charge Ed Buck with anything, even though close to a dozen young Black gay men had come forward with videos and photos and text messages and screenshots, you know, detailing what had happened to them at Ed Buck's house. The DA's office still didn't do anything. And that was July 2018. January of this year, Timothy Dean died in Ed Buck's apartment of a crystal meth overdose on the same mattress that was on the floor of the same apartment. It was surreal, but it was something that we had said to the district attorney here in Los Angeles and to law enforcement was bound to happen if the man wasn't stopped.
Yeah, a tragedy that feels like could have been averted if people in a position of power had taken it seriously. And so after the first individual died, eventually nothing legal happens. This year, a second individual dies. Is it being taken more seriously? Is there the chance that there will be something like justice in this case?
I'm hopeful. I have to, you know, try to remain somewhat hopeful. You need to do that in this kind of work, right? So we're in this weird waiting stage again, waiting to figure out what the district attorney's office is going to do, if anything. Yesterday, I spent a lot of time talking about the situation with Mac Miller and the person who was charged, because it was a very similar situation with the Ed Buck case. In both of the deaths, there was an enormous amount of drugs found, everything from cocaine to heroin to meth, everything. And they still did not charge Ed Buck with anything. As a matter of fact, through Ed Buck's attorney, he said that those young men, that those men brought all of those drugs over to his apartment. So, you know, we're waiting to see. Jamel Moore's mother, Ms. Nixon, she has filed a civil lawsuit against Ed Buck in the death of her son. I know that Timothy Dean's family is also considering doing the same thing. And simply, this is because, you know, we have to get justice one way or the other, right? If we can't get justice through the criminal court system because the lives of Black gay men, you know, Black gay men who may be sex workers and homeless and poor are not as important as the lives of other people, then we have to try to get that justice through the civil court system.
Yeah. It seems, looking at this from an outsider, it just seems insane, the entire thing that like, I would have to imagine that if the same thing had happened to me, for instance, you don't get one free death on your watch, let alone two free deaths. And look, so we know that across the country, there are multiple justice systems. Depending on how much money you have, you might get one or the other. Does it feel like this is just a clear case where the deaths, let alone also just the drugs being there and it happening multiple times, is this just an instance of this is a well-connected, powerful, influential person?
Yes, exactly. So that's something I've been fighting with the Democratic Party about as well, me being a Democrat. It's like, as a Black woman, as a Black person, I cannot belong to a party that can look the other way when these things happen because a major donor of yours is involved, right? And at the time that Jamel Moore died, Ed Buck's best friend was the chair of the California Democratic Party. And the California Democratic Party is the largest Democratic organization outside of DC. So, you know, it's created a myriad of issues and problems and sort of put a spotlight on the intersection of, you know, exactly how much do Black lives matter, particularly when we're talking about a major donor who has given over $500,000 in the last 7 to 8 years to candidates and elected officials here in Los Angeles. So yeah, but you know, it's not like you stop. We have to keep doing this because, you know, when I tell people that another young Black gay man can die in Ed Buck's house at any moment, that is not a joke. Yeah. That is serious because he has not stopped his behavior.
And so would you say it's fair to say that you do fear that if there aren't consequences, that we will inevitably see a third case like this?
Oh, absolutely. I was clear about that in July of 2018. I'm clear about that today in 2019. This is a man who has not stopped the same predatory behavior that he was engaging in prior to Jamel Moore's death. I have young men that reach out to me all of the time, you know, saying, oh, you know, this man just tried to pick me up on this website, or this man just tried to pick me up here. So he's still engaging in the same behavior. His neighbors contact me all the time and let me know, like, look, he just brought someone else in. He's doing this again.
That is, the entire case, so difficult to understand that two people die on your watch and you're thirsty for more. It, absolutely insane. Journalist Jasmine Kanick, thank you so much for joining us and breaking down the case.
Thank you so much for having me.
We're going to take a short break here. We come back. We're going to take you back to the run-up to the war in Iraq. What were some of the candidates who were then in government, now running for president, saying about that war back before it happened? Joe Biden has got a long track record, and certain parts of it haven't hurt him too much yet in this Democratic primary, but they almost certainly will at some point. The biggest one, the standout vote, would have to be his both vote for and support for the war in Iraq. There are only two of the many candidates running in the Democratic primary who are actually in a position to vote for or against that war. And Joe Biden didn't just support it, he vocally advocated for it in a number of different ways. But that's not the story he's telling these days. If you ask him now, he was never all that into the war, okay? And let's take a look at what's changed between back then, all of his quotes, and we've got many of them, and the way he's talking about it now. Now he says, I think my record has been good. He told NPR. He explained that his rationale in authorizing the use of military force in Iraq back in 2002 was based on a commitment he had received from then President George W. Bush that he would not go to war in Iraq. So, yes, I supported it, but I supported it to oppose it. I supported it so that there wouldn't be a war. He says, in particular, Bush looked me in the eye in the Oval Office. He said he needed the vote to be able to get inspectors into Iraq to determine whether or not Saddam Hussein was engaged in dealing with a nuclear program. He got them in, and before you know it, we had shock and awe, okay? And so then he transitions and says, from the moment shock and awe started, from that moment, I was opposed to the effort, and I was outspoken as much as anyone at all in the Congress and the administration. So look, that is a bold statement. Not just all that you've heard about me on this issue is wrong, but it's so wrong that I was actually one of the most outspoken against it. You should be giving me credit for opposing the war in Iraq. Okay, well, that's what he says now. So we're going to go back and we're going to look at some of his past statements. I apologize, there's a lot here, but you need to understand not just generally what he has said, but how often and how many different contexts he said it. So much like Neo in the Matrix, I'm going to fill you full of kung fu right now, and so just get ready. So look, he said back in a speech at the Brookings Institution in 2003, July 31st, he said, 9 months ago, I voted with my colleagues to give the President of the United States of America the authority to use force, and I would vote that way again today. It was a right vote then, and it'll be a correct vote today. So look, we're talking about now with hindsight, almost a year of hindsight on the war, he says, not only was I right, but I would still vote, which is a far cry from the second shock and awe happened, I knew I'd made a mistake in trusting that man. So let's see, he said in advance, I'm trying to give you all the context, an immediate invasion of Iraq, he said in remarks to the Council of Foreign Relations in October 2001, was not the prudent approach. But before that makes you think that he's against it, he says a case needed to be made for international support. That same day, he went on Charlie Rose, and he said that he felt the US could lead an international coalition, but didn't necessarily need to wait for allies to take action. So look, he's gonna be able to pitch the first part as saying, I was only saying, you know, we need to get together the international community. But then he was going to the media and saying, sure, we could lead an international coalition, but we don't need to. I mean, that's the same sort of like pro-unilateral approach that we were getting from George W. Bush. So far from, I only support this so that diplomacy can go forward, he's effectively saying that this is gonna happen and it's gonna happen one way or the other. If we have allies, that's great. If we don't have allies, we might still need to do it ourselves. More on this. He said, I think if we do this well, this is, I believe, to Larry King. I think if we do this well and we're capable of doing it, we can essentially tighten the noose around Saddam Hussein's neck so that when he does genuinely step out of line next time, we will either have the ability to move in with or without others, but with the support of the rest of the world like we're doing now in Afghanistan. I think that eventually we go to Iraq, but in my view, Larry, is the question is how we go to Iraq. Do we go to Iraq unilaterally without having built a case against Saddam, either having been involved in 9/11 or having violated tighter sanctions that we designed that tightened the noose around him? So look, start to put these pieces together. And what you have is him trying to push before the war his support for it being just about diplomacy. But now, again, this is before the war, there is this sense of inevitability that one way or another, we're going to Iraq. We can debate, you know, whether it's part of a coalition or unilateral. We can debate whether the rationale is one or another, different things, but we're going to it one way or another. And it really feels like both the noose tightening and the international diplomacy is really just about putting a cloak of, well, we had to do it. We're being responsible. We're not just going in there because we want to. It's really about like gilding the lily. That's all it is. We're going in. We want it to look right, but we're going in. That's the important part. And that is a far cry from, I was the most vocal against this war. Who says, I think that eventually we go to Iraq, but how do we go to Iraq? If you are the most opposed to it, you don't have that sense of like futility, like fatalism, like it's gonna happen. I mean, what are you gonna do? Honestly, I'm just a senator. What could I possibly do to stop this? But there's more. In a speech at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, Biden said the US would need, quote, to end the regime one way or another, and it would be, quote, downright foolish to believe the war on terror could be won if Hussein was still in power in 5 years. And so now let's add this piece to the puzzle. He takes the war on terror so seriously, how could we possibly prosecute it? How could we possibly continue it internationally if we allowed Saddam Hussein to stay in power for the next 5 years? So again, this is not just an opposition to the regime. This is not just about how we go in, but this is tying it into other foreign policy goals, which by the way, again, was exactly what George W. Bush and the neocons were doing at the time. Sure, they hated Saddam Hussein in his own right, for his own reasons, but they also tied it into other geopolitical goals that they wanted to pursue. And again, far from the most vocal opponent to this, Joe Biden was out there in the media, talking to think tanks, doing interviews, pushing the same exact message in a number of different ways. And so look, let's talk about right before the war. So the idea that he was most opposed to it. This is 3 days before the invasion of Iraq. This is a press release. This is go time. We have one last chance possibly to rally support against this war. Here is what he says. The president has concluded that the time for diplomacy is over and the time for action is at hand. Many Americans are concerned about how we got to this point and the lost opportunities along the way. But if we go to war in Iraq, we must all unite behind our men and women in uniform. I'm confident of their extraordinary skill and ultimate success. By refusing to disarm, a defiant Saddam has made the fateful choice between war and peace. Let us make sure that in winning the war, we also win the peace. Look, if you're pro-peace, I guess you like the end of it, right? We want to win the peace. Yay, he said peace, but the rest of it is terrible. Again, fatalism, inevitability, we're definitely going. And look, you can say, like if you put yourself back in the context of that time, virtually no one was speaking out in an elected position against the war in Iraq. And so I guess he just had to do it, right? No, that's not leadership. That's not a record you run for when you want to be president a couple decades later. That's a, I was no better or worse than anyone else at that time. And I'm gonna actually fight against that notion in 1 second. Just the idea that we have to unite behind them. No, We don't. If we think that this is a wasteful war, if we think this is going to lead to thousands of our soldiers being killed, if we think that this could result in the deaths of over 100,000 Iraqis, then it is our job, our responsibility, and indeed, when you're a senator, your privilege to be able to speak out against it. You had a press release. That means the press cares what you say. They're going to take it. They're going to talk about it in the news. And instead, what do? You just support George W. Bush. That's not speaking out against the war. That's not being the most vocal critic of the war. That is going along with the neocon foreign policy agenda. That's all it was at that time. And look, a couple of years later, he does turn against it, but it took a while. It was November of 2005, 2.5 years later on Meet the Press, that he finally said it was a mistake. It was a mistake to assume the president would use the authority we gave him properly. I never argued that there was an imminent threat. We gave the president the authority to unite the world to isolate Saddam. And the fact of the matter is, we went too soon. We went without sufficient force, and we went without a plan. But Joe, you were down to go when they went. We must unite behind our men and women in arms. Like, that's what you said. No, you could have been pushing for a plan. You could have done that same press release and said, I care so much about the lives of our soldiers that I cannot back an agenda by this administration that sends them into harm's way with no plan for what happens when the entire thing blows up. And you might think, well, wait a second, everybody was talking about this being so easy. How could he have known at that time that it would go so poorly? How could he have known that there was no plan to win the war, let alone to win the peace? How could he have known that so many would die? How could he have known that it would cost so much? The thing is, this is not just looking at this particular instance with hindsight. There were politicians, one of whom is running for president now, who ahead of the war, back when there was still time to rally opposition to it, was doing everything he could. And he saw the mistakes, not 2 years after, 2.5 years after the invasion, but in advance of it. And so I want to play a section of this. Bernie Sanders, this is before the war. Here is what he had to say.
Mr. Speaker, in the brief time I have, let me give you 5 reasons why I'm opposed to giving the president a blank check to launch a unilateral invasion and occupation of Iraq, and why I will vote against this resolution. One, I have not heard any estimates of how many young American men and women might die in such a war, or how many tens of thousands of women and children in Iraq might also be killed. As a caring nation, we should do everything we can to prevent the horrible suffering that a war will cause. War must be the last recourse in international relations, not the first. Second, I am deeply concerned about the precedent that a unilateral invasion of Iraq could establish in terms of international law and the role of the United Nations. If President Bush believes that the U.S. can go to war at any time against any nation, what moral or legal obligation could our government raise if another country chose to do the same thing? At a time when this country has a $6 trillion national debt and a growing deficit, we should be clear that a war and a long-term American occupation of Iraq could be extremely expensive. Fifth, I am concerned about the problems of so-called unintended consequences. Who will govern Iraq when Saddam Hussein is removed? And what role will the U.S. play in an ensuing civil war that could develop in that country? Will moderate governments in the region who have large Islamic fundamentalist populations be overthrown and replaced by extremists?
So look, honestly, looking back on this entire history up until today, I have to say that we are oddly blessed to have two politicians who were there to vote for or against the war, who are now running against each other. One who just went along with the administration, buttressing its points, spreading its talking points, supporting the war, and only coming to grips with how much of a mistake it was literally years later. And another who understood shockingly well all of the potential problems in advance of the war. The costs, the deaths, the waste, the chaos. What we're in right now, Bernie Sanders saw it coming a long, long time ago. And so it's weird that Joe Biden hasn't yet really suffered at all in the polls for his support in the war in Iraq. I understand that it's not a gigantic priority for a lot of voters right now. But once this crowd of candidates starts to get weaned down a little bit, and it becomes a bigger topic where they can start to directly differentiate ourselves, this sort of history is going to come out. It's important that we understand what was actually done, what was actually said back then, and don't allow these candidates to just rewrite history to benefit themselves now. Okay, we're gonna take a short break. We come back, the opioid crisis, how the media's gotten it wrong after this. It is 2019 and we are still pretending as a country that we are not losing so many people to the opioid crisis. The numbers are insane and the lack of attention on it is perhaps the only thing more insane. According to preliminary data from the CDC, there were more than 68,000 drug overdose deaths in 2018 compared to 72,000 the year before. So hey, the numbers are getting a little bit better. At least they've sort of leveled off, but don't get too excited yet because between 2011 and 2012, drug overdose deaths also appeared to level off. That was back when they were just 41,500. And then fentanyl and the numbers shot up over the next few years. So this is a serious problem, not much being done about it. And I want to educate myself and the audience about it more. And so we're joined now by a writer for The Wrap, Lindsay Ellefson. Welcome to The Damage Report.
Hi, it's so nice to see you.
It's great to have you here. And thank you for joining us about this topic. I know that it's something you've written quite a bit about. And so let's start to talk about the opioid crisis, misconceptions both in the public and the media. Let's start off, what are some of the biggest misconceptions about this crisis?
Some of the biggest misconceptions about the overdose crisis, that's actually a really good question. I've spent a lot of time speaking to drug users, people with substance use disorders, people who are in recovery, people who are actively using, who are trying to get into recovery. They all tell me different things that they see as the big misconceptions. And I think that itself kind of speaks to what we have to tackle in the media when we're finding that everybody that I've spoken to has such a different experience. But the thing that they all primarily tell me is the main misconception is that there is one person that a substance use disorder individual looks like. They're saying that in the media and in the public eye, in the public mind, somebody who has an addiction or a dependency problem is actually either someone strung out behind a 7-Eleven or someone who fell to a terrible tragedy, maybe an athlete who got hurt and got overprescribed opioids and now is living this addicted life and is so sad. The big misconception is that you either fall into one of those two categories. And in reality, there are people with substance use disorders all around us. One person that I've spoken to at length for a number of things that I've worked on and projects I've done tells me that if you believe that you do not know anyone with a substance use problem, you are living in denial. They are all around us. They are our friends, our family, and there is a human face, millions of human faces that go along with these stories.
Do you feel, is that just a popular misconception or do you feel that the media is actually contributing to that?
You know what? I feel strongly, personally, that the media is contributing to that. The people that I've spoken to, when I started doing my project looking into the way the media represents substance use disorders and the way the media represents the overdose crisis, I thought we were going to be looking more broadly at large national media because to me, they are extreme perpetrators of this very tunnel vision sort of look at what this crisis really looks like. But the more I spoke to people on the ground who are really living in this situation, people whose daily lives are dictated and whose daily lives are affected by substance use like this, they're pointing to the local media as being a huge problem for them. They think that local papers and blogs that are obsessively in their mind chronicling crime as it relates to drugs are perpetrating a lot worse stereotypes that affect them daily in their communities. So on the one hand, you have larger outlets that are struggling to kind of portray what this looks like in the way that national media does when they have a difficult time getting someone on the ground in these small communities and these impoverished communities, and then just like throwing up a 2-minute clip on a morning show seen by millions that doesn't really illuminate anything. And then on the other hand, you have these local media outlets that are really digging in there and providing comment spaces, for instance, that are run muck with some of the most negative local commentary that doesn't do anything to help anybody.
Yeah, I'm curious. So if so many people have some fairly fundamentally false ideas of what the crisis is actually like, who it's actually affecting, how do you think that that might be affecting what they want politicians or the government to do about it? So obviously, we all agree that it's a crisis that needs to be dealt with, but if we don't have the facts about the crisis, are we pushing for the right changes?
Oh, absolutely not. You can talk to anybody. I mean, I dare you to just go up to anybody, call up a relative that you don't speak to every day and ask them their general opinion of drug users. And I'm thinking even in my own life, some of the most compassionate, kind, and genuinely well-informed people I know are quick to use words like junkies, druggies, crackheads. They're quick to like throw out these extremely nasty words and say the world is better off without them. If you look in the comment sections of a lot of the local news outlets that I've been looking into, you're going to find that even when the article is written very straight, very, you know, down the middle, here's exactly what happened and when and why, and you can debate whether or not they should be highlighting all of the crime and arrests that go on in the drug crisis, whatever. But when you look at the articles, they're straight down the middle. But when you look at the comments, people are saying, I'm glad this person died. This person is a scourge. I don't need this person in my community. We don't need these people in our community. So when you're looking at that strong of a public opinion coming at you from personal people in your own life, people in comment sections on the internet, even if they're just reading the most basic benign thing, that is what we're up against. It's very difficult if you're trying to take that opinion and turn it into something concrete that genuinely helps people, either like through the government or through community outreach programs. You always find that right now, the general overall consensus is these people are a waste of space and I don't care about it. Why should I care about it? Why should I vote for politicians who care about it? And why should I work with my community on things that can help these people?
Wow, that is incredibly depressing. Weird that comment sections would cause us to lose faith. Wow, that is sad. So we're gonna have to end on that dark note now. So I wanted to start with misconceptions. Hopefully, I'd like to have you back in the very near future to start to talk about some potential solutions. What can politicians actually do? And I want your evaluation of the efforts under the Trump administration. But for now,
I got him.
What's that?
I got evaluations for you.
Okay, so we're going to talk about that very soon. Lindsay Ellefson, writer for The Wrap, thank you so much for joining us today.
Of course, thank you.
We're going to take a short break here. We come back. Congressman Steve King drinks out of a toilet after this.
Not bad.
Not bad. That's Congressman Steve King drinking out of a toilet, or at least a sink directly attached to a toilet. If that seems weird, it is. His reason for doing it even weirder. But before that, here's his evaluation of the quality of the water coming out of that. He says, I took a drink out of there and actually pretty good. It's not drinking out of the toilet, it's drinking out of the water fountain that's integral with the back of the toilet. So look, he thinks that he has a point in doing this. He does, but perhaps not the one that he thinks he does. So why is he doing it? Well, he's doing it because back in July, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez visited the border and said that she was told by detainees that they were specifically told that the water fountains were broken and that personnel suggested they drink from the toilet bowl instead. And look, that is not lost. The connection there is not lost at all on Steve King. He made it very clear when he tweeted that video out and said, I hope you will include this video in NBC's coverage, to an NBC reporter. No way was AOC objectively honest in her hashtag fake news spin about the border. Clickbait for snowflakes. So to give you an idea of how serious this literal congressman is, he put a hashtag fake news and talked about snowflakes after drinking out of that toilet. Now, AOC, who rightly got a lot of credit for repeatedly drawing attention from back before she even won her primary, to today on the conditions on the border, she responded saying there's a genre of videos where GOP House members who clearly didn't read sworn testimony that detention sinks were broken, filming themselves drinking out of toilet sinks. They're so anti-immigrant they risk pink eye to show off that they didn't do the reading, hashtag close the camps. And look, the thing is, I have no idea if you can get pink eye from this. They keep saying it's not a toilet, it's a sink. Look, they're attached to each other. She was lying. But she wasn't lying. It's sworn testimony. And what was being asserted was not that they had to drink out of sinks attached to toilets. It's that the sinks were broken. And so they were told to drink out of the literal toilet bowls. That is the simplest point to understand imaginable. They're held in detention. They're told to drink out of the literal toilet bowl. That is what multiple detainees in sworn testimony said. And their response is, well, look, I found a sink that works. Yes, genius, you can find a sink that works. You can find a bottle of Aquafina. There are sources of water that aren't toilets, but I'm concerned about the fact that these refugees are being forced to drink out of the actual toilets. This is a congressman. This is a person with power in the US government who either can't understand that extraordinarily simple point or refuses to because his quest is to demonize immigrants, and he will go to literally any lengths, no matter how far it takes him away from reality, to do so. We really have two types of people in this country. People who look at a politician like AOC and say, look at her. She is governing with empathy, shedding light on important issues that are actually affecting people, people's health. And then there's people like Steve King, who I guess has some free time since he has no more congressional committee assignments because he's so racist, even the GOP had to kick him out, who's traveling the border to lie about what people have said to hurt immigrants. You really have to choose at this point which side you're on. Okay, that's all the time we have, unfortunately. Thank you so much for watching. We're going to close out tomorrow with Brett Ehrlich. We'll see you then. Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Derola. I'll see you soon.